Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Simon R. Green's Deathstalker Destiny. Narrated and directed by Richard Rowan. With performances by Terrence Acil Ford, Nanette Savard, Colleen Delaney, David Coyne, Anne Flosnick, Kate Torrey, Nick Sampson, Corey James, Karen Carbone, Thomas Penny, Chris Rowan, and Mort Shelby. Graphic audio sound design by Dan Smith. Episode 5, The Last Deathstalker. Previously in Deathstalker Destiny,
what could be so dangerous, so frightening, that a whole sentient species would turn themselves into mindless killing machines?
The Recreated have finally come out of the dark to destroy us all.
Is that why you're sending Silence back into the Dark Void? Have you sent him off to the Dark Void device?
You must return to the Wolfling world. The Madness Maze has returned, and the baby is waking up.
We'll come right away.
We know who the carrier is for the nanoplague. It's Daniel Wolf.
My own invulnerability comes from nanotech. Sharp introduced the busy little things into my system, and now nothing can damage me for long.
The war is over. Sharp is recalling its forces and shutting down its nanotech. The plague will spread no further.
I can't be seen with you publicly.
You can wear a mask. We'll call you the Unknown Clone.
Finlay Campbell is dead and laid to rest in his family crypt, and I'm just as happy to leave it that way. I have a new life now, without all the complications from my old one.
What's happened about the royal wedding? I mean, if everyone thinks I'm dead...
It's still going ahead. Only Constance is marrying Robert Campbell instead.
Ah, Parliament follows where we lead. Your people? The Chojiros?
No, Robert. Blue Block.
Be reasonable and persuasive, and you and your beautiful intended can have a long and happy life together. Persist in being our enemy, and she shall die.
You wouldn't dare! I'm Blue Block! You don't dare hurt me!
And I'm Kid Death, and I don't give a damn. Release him.
Never!
Very well.
Nothing matters now. Nothing. You haven't just killed a woman. You've killed Blue Block itself. She was Blue Block. Just her.
So, I suppose things have a way of turning out right. Eventually, I'm marrying Robert Campbell, and he will make a fine king and a better husband. Who says there are no happy endings anymore?
Up in the director's gallery, occupying part of Parliament's security center, Toby Schreck and his assistants sat hunched over their control panels, watching the display of monitor screens showing what the cameramen down on the floor of the house and its antechamber were broadcasting. It was all going out live, with a few seconds delay so they could edit out any foul language, and the current audience totals were bigger than anything Toby had ever known, even during the last days of the rebellion. Practically everyone in the Empire who had access to a holoscreen and wasn't actually under attack was watching his show. Toby couldn't stop grinning, even when his cheeks ached from the strain. He spoke quietly to his assistants at the control and mixing boards, switching from one camera to another as something interesting caught his eye. Every now and then he'd have a quiet word with his cameramen through their comm implants, telling them to concentrate on this person or that gathering, or when to pull back and look away, rather than show some unpleasant incident or ill feeling that might distract from the general joy of the occasion. This wasn't a documentary, after all. This was supposed to be a morale booster for humanity. And for once, Toby Schreck was following instructions. He knew how vital it was that everything was seen to go well. Besides, his cameras were recording a lot more than they were transmitting, and by rights, it all belonged to him. Later on, he'd put together a warts-and-all documentary that would really open people's eyes. assuming there was a later on. On Toby Schreck's many screens, movers and shakers and aristocrats and celebrities cluster together, putting aside, for one day at least, old hatreds and animosities, as they waited impatiently for a wedding that would change the whole nature of the Empire yet again. In a huge antechamber packed almost literally from wall to wall, the guests were growing restless. Overcome by the immensity of the occasion and the increasingly sauna-like conditions, they'd been knocking back the complimentary champagne as fast as the circulating waiters could get it to them. Faces were becoming flushed, voices louder, opinions more vehement. Anyone, even the least bit interesting, was seized on by the guests to distract them from their boredom, the heat, and the impossibly long queues for the toilets. The actor, who now played the part of the daredevil Esper Julian Skye in the continuing Hollow Adventure show, was having a great time. The show was bigger than ever these days, and the star was a much better actor than the real Julian had ever been. Most assumed the Esper's sudden tragic death had been a suicide pact with Bibi Chojiro, that the two lovebirds had chosen to die together rather than be separated by Julian's growing illness. Others spoke darkly of Chojiro and even Blue Block conspiracies, and hinted that Julian had been murdered because he had been ready to make dangerous public remarks about his time with BB. Either way, it was all very romantic. The public did so love a tragic hero, and Julian Skye's reputation grew ever more noble and heroic, now he was safely gone and unable to contradict it. The best legends have always been based on the dead. Bruin Bear and the Sea Goat, those two most notable toys and ambassadors from Akeldama, were there as well. Evangeline had arranged for their invitations, partly as an excuse to see old friends again, and partly to demonstrate to the Empire that the infamous killer toys of Akeldama were now much more civilized. Unfortunately, most of Toby Schreck's films on Akeldama had been overlooked due to the increasing coverage of the imminent rebellion, and as a result, only the bad news had stuck. As a further result, most of the wedding guests were openly petrified by Bruin Bear and the Sea Goat. The bear honestly didn't notice and was polite and charming to everyone, even as they babbled meaningless excuses and ran away from him. The Sea Goat had noticed and was playing up to it for all he was worth by making pointed remarks that on the surface seemed perfectly straightforward, but which could also very easily be taken for veiled threats. He'd also acquired a taste for champagne and terrorizing the waiters. Bruin Bear persisted in his attempts to be a good ambassador for the new Akeldama, while the Sea Goat kept baring his huge blocky teeth in a terrible smile and pretending not to notice when people cringed back from him. The two toys had trapped Donna Silvestri in a corner, and she stared at them with wide, terrified eyes as the bear innocently tried to make small talk with her. Toby got it all on film, but after a while he weakened and sent Flynn over to interview the two toys. Donna Silvestri seized her chance, gathered up her skirts, and ran for her life.
Bye-bye, Lady Silvestri.
Bruin Bear waved after her, puzzled, while the Sea Goat sniggered into his champagne glass. Flynn chatted happily with the toys, sharing reminiscences of their time traveling together on the abandoned pleasure planet, and everyone else in the antechamber was openly impressed by the cameraman's calm composure in the face of such danger. Unbeknownst to Flynn or Toby Schreck, or indeed anybody else, Valentine Wolfe was also present in the antechamber. He moved calmly among the chattering throng, smiling and nodding to all, hidden behind a shub hologram disguise that gave him the seeming appearance of a Sister of Mercy. His invitation, an absolutely impeccable forgery, said he was there to represent Mother Superior Beatrice, the Saint of Technos III, and now Lacrimae Christi. The shub camera on his shoulder produced a faultless visual image, undetectable even at very close range, and modified his distinctive voice into that of an anonymous young woman. The illusion wouldn't have withstood the touch test, but who was going to touch a nun? Valentine would have preferred to rely on his own minor esp abilities rather than have to rely on tech under someone else's control, but unfortunately, that just wasn't possible. The security elves on the perimeter would have spotted him in a moment, and even if he could have found a way into the house, the living S-blockers would have blown away his illusion immediately. At least the Shub tech was clearly superior to any of the Empire's security devices. Under Shub's cloaking hollow, he could go anywhere, a ghost from the Empire's troubled past, a deadly specter at the feast. He stood in the middle of the crowded antechamber, unnoticed and unchallenged, and smiled contentedly. Of all the many disguises he could have chosen, the nun appealed to him most. He liked the outfit. Its stark black and white complemented his extreme nature. And as for masquerading as one of St. Bee's nuns, well, Beatrice was still technically his fiancée. He was sure she'd understand.
I will have her. Oh, yes. Once the deliciously terrible thing I planned to do is over, I'll just have Shub seize Beatrice and bring her to me. The naughty little minx has put off our union for far too long. I forgive her. She's just playing hard to get. After all, what's a few death threats between soulmates? I will wed her, and on our wedding night I will show her such awful pleasures. And when she is dead, I'll do other things to her.
His plans for the royal wedding ceremony were simplicity itself. He was going to murder Robert and Constance, right there in front of everyone, and then declare himself emperor. He hadn't actually told Shub that, they just thought he was here as an observer, but no doubt it would come as a nice surprise to them.
This nun hollow will get me close to the happy couple, under the guise of bestowing a benediction from St. Beatrice, and then a disruptor shot to Robert's smiling face, a slashed throat for Constance, and that will be that. I'm quite looking forward to killing Constance. I always wanted to kill my stepmother. One more thing off the list. A pity there isn't time to ravish her first, as one more spit in the eye for dear dead daddy. But no plan is perfect. Maybe there'll be time afterward. And if not, I suppose I'll have to settle for the look in her dying eyes as I drop my disguise, so she shall know in her last moments just who has killed her and her Campbell lover. A wolf marrying a Campbell? Unthinkable! Someone has to preserve the old decencies. And once they're dead, I know that the aristocracy will flock to support me. They've always understood and appreciated real power. And as emperor, I shall destroy the empire as Shub never could from within. I will crush their spirit, reduce them all to mad animals feasting on one another, and then watch the empire burn. I will delight in its death agonies and dance in its screaming ruins. I've always known that that is my destiny.
And even if the aristocrats or security or anyone else rose up against him, it would do them no good. Shub had filled him full of nanotech that could repair any damage to his body pretty much instantly. Finley Campbell had shot him in the chest with a disruptor at point-blank range and he'd still survived. Though admittedly, it had taken the nanos a while to build him a new heart. Afterward, he'd walked through the flames of the Burning Tower Shrek with impunity, ignoring his roasting flesh, already planning his revenge. He was unstoppable now, unkillable, perhaps even immortal, and flying on every drug known to man, plus a few he'd had Shub whip up specially, just for him. Anyone else would have died from the extraordinary cocktail of chemicals circulating in his bloodstream, but Valentine just took that as one more sign of his clear superiority. His mind was so sharp now he could outthink anyone, or anything. Let Shub beware. All around him, people's faces and body language shouted volumes of information to his expanded senses. He was faster, stronger, and more devious than any other mere mortal could hope to be. The only ones who might have hoped to stop him weren't here. Jack Random and Ruby Journey were currently facing obliteration at the steel hands of the Shub Armada, and Owen Deathstalker and Hazel Dark were already dead.
Ah, such a pity that. I would have liked to talk with Owen one last time. The Deathstalker is probably the only person left who could have appreciated the terrible and wondrous thing I've made of myself. And I would have enjoyed going one-on-one with Owen, sword to sword. He has always been my greatest challenge. The Deathstalker deserved a better death, a better end to his legend than just missing in action, presumed dead. I would have killed him with style and grace, giving Owen a death so appalling people would have talked of it for centuries.
What the bloody hell?
Off to one side, Flynn studied the Sister of Mercy through his camera and tried to figure out what was wrong. His camera was state-of-the-art and quite definitely picking up some kind of energy field, but he was damned if he could tell what. Of course, it could be just a malfunction, or even him reading the displays incorrectly. Flynn was always at least one manual behind whatever state-of-the-art his camera happened to be in. He wondered vaguely if he should mention it to security or Toby. And then the Shrek's voice was suddenly ringing loudly in his ear.
Flynn, pay attention!
attention to the good stuff, will you?
An argument was growing between two female celebrities who had unfortunately chosen the same outfit from a supposedly exclusive fashion guru. Flynn immediately sent his camera flying toward the trouble spot and hurried after as best he could. Real news always had to take priority. Finally, it was time. The great double doors swung open, and everyone in the antechamber surged forward onto the floor of the house. Strategically placed security elves kept the fighting for position to a minimum. No one wanted to risk being excluded from the ceremony. The happy couple were already in place, magnificent in their traditional attire, standing together on the raised dais that had once held the speaker's chair. Cardinal Brendan stood before them, ready to perform the wedding, and then oversee the investiture. He held his prayer book to his chest like a shield and tried not to look at Kid Death, standing quietly to one side. The floor of the house was soon packed solid, shoulder to shoulder, as Robert Campbell and Constance Wolfe took their vows, while the whole empire watched and listened.
Do you, Robert, take Constance to be your wife and queen, to have and to hold from this day forward?
The cardinal ran smoothly through the service, and Robert and Constance's voices were firm and steady. The choir sang beautifully, and rose petals rained down from the galleries. Delicate rainbows shone through the stained glass windows. An almost completely overwhelmed page brought forward the ceremonial golden cord on its platter. Constance calmed him with a smile, and his hands were steady as he held the platter out to the cardinal. Brendan took the cord and wrapped it loosely around their wrists, symbolically binding them together. Crow Jane of the Elves stepped forward then, cold and magisterial as the occasion demanded, to probe the minds of the bride and groom, as tradition demanded.
I declare Robert and Constance true and entire in their given identities.
There was only the slightest pause as she did this, but to Robert, it seemed to last forever. He lived again the terrible events that followed this part of the ceremony at his first wedding. For a moment, he thought he might faint. The unknown clone saw him sway slightly on his feet and grabbed Robert firmly but surreptitiously by the arm, steadying him. But all went well. When Crojane proclaimed their true identities, Robert's quiet sigh of relief went unnoticed.
By the authority invested in me, I hereby declare you husband and wife, and our constitutional king and queen.
Robert kissed his bride, remembering at the very last moment to lift her veil first, and the whole audience cheered, in the house and across the empire. Flynn was right there with his camera, getting it all. Two members of parliament, chosen strictly by lot, came forward with the two newly made crowns, simple golden frames encrusted with the empire's most precious and radiant stones. Robert and Constance knelt before them and were crowned at the hands of the people. The two crowns were lowered onto their heads simultaneously to demonstrate king and queen were equal in power and status. The two constitutional monarchs rose to their feet and smiled out over the people, and everyone cheered again and again and again as though they might never stop. Afterward, the wedding banquet was a loud, noisy, and altogether more relaxed affair. There was no room for seats, so everyone just grabbed a plate and some cutlery and provided for themselves. Robert and Constance made the rounds, smiling and shaking hands, and making sure everyone had enough to eat. There was the traditional cake, 12 tiers high, and enough champagne to float a medium-sized ship, and an apparently endless buffet table, almost collapsing under the weight of delicacies from 100 worlds. It took a while for Robert and Constance to get anywhere. Everyone wanted to pay their compliments to the new king and queen, and to be seen doing it on Hollow. Politics never takes a holiday. But still, it was a time of happy chatter and loud laughter, with good humor and good fellowship for all. Or very nearly. Kit Summerisle had been quietly following the royal couple on their rounds at a discreet distance when he spotted a familiar but unexpected face in the crowd. He paused just long enough to be sure that Crow Jane and the unknown clone were watching over the king and queen, and then he moved quietly through the press of bodies to intercept his chosen target. The man had a new name and title now, as Sir Slayton Dubois, that wasn't how Kit knew him. Sir Slayton had once been the steward of David Deathstalker's standing on Viramond. The steward had been sworn to David's service, but instead had betrayed his master to the Lord High Dram's forces when they invaded Viramond. Because of the steward's betrayal, the castle standing had fallen, and David died in Kit's arms. Kit had never forgotten that. He'd lost track of the steward during the upheavals of the last days of the rebellion, but he never gave up the search. Eventually, he discovered that Lionstone had rewarded the steward with a new name and a minor title, but Kit was patient. He'd known a social climber like the steward would be unable to miss the royal wedding, and sure enough, here he was, bold as brass. The Summer Isle came to a sudden halt in front of the ex-steward, and took a certain cold satisfaction in watching all the color drain out of the man's face.
Ah, steward. So good to see you again after all this time.
You can't touch me. I have a new life now. Aristocratic friends, influence, protection.
I know who and what you are. I am now Warrior Prime to the Empire, charged by the king himself with hunting down and dealing with traitors. Come with me, traitor.
Kit dropped an apparently friendly hand onto Sir Slayton's shoulder, and his fingers dug harshly into an exposed nerve there. The ex-steward grimaced, but made no move to resist as the Summer Isle steered him through the crowds and into the adjoining kitchens. A few people looked at them askance, but no one said anything. The Summer Isle half threw his captive into the kitchens and carefully shut the swinging doors behind him. The kitchen staff fell back, abandoning their responsibilities. They knew who Kit Summer Isle was. The ex-steward backed away, rubbing almost childishly at the pain in his abused shoulder.
I have position. I could do a lot for you. I have money. I could make you rich.
Can you raise the dead?
What?
I thought not. And you have nothing else I want. I've waited a long time for this moment, steward.
Sir Slayton Dubois turned and tried to run, but Kid Death was upon him before he managed more than a few steps. He dragged the ex-steward over to a great, brimming punch bowl, bent him over, and then thrust the man's head down into the punch until it covered his ears. The ex-steward kicked and struggled, but Kit held him down remorselessly. The kitchen staff watched, horrified, but no one even thought of interfering with Kid Death. It took a while for the ex-steward to drown, but Kit was in no hurry. Finally, the bubbles stopped rising to the surface of the punch, and the ex-Sir Slayton Dubois was still. Kit held him under a while longer, smiling gently, and then let him go. The dead body fell to the floor, eyes staring, mouth wide, lungs full of the most expensive punch.
For you, David, my love.
Back on the floor of the house, Cardinal Brendan had been called away to speak with a young Sister of Mercy, who had an urgent message from St. Beatrice. The Cardinal had been happy to go, glad of any excuse that would allow him to disappear while the Summer Isle wasn't around and watching. He didn't have long to be happy, though. The smiling young nun steered him into one of the empty private rooms, locked the door behind him, and with practiced skill, slid a wicked-looking knife between the Cardinal's ribs. Brendan sank to the floor, both hands clasped to his side, as though he could somehow hold in the life that was escaping from him, along with the gushing blood. He lived just long enough to see the hollow disguise drop away, revealing the smiling face of Valentine Wolfe. And then the Cardinal died. Valentine refigured the hollow camera on his shoulder, so that now he appeared to be Cardinal Brendan.
The damned elf security kept my non-persona far from the actual ceremony, but no one will stop Cardinal Brendan. What could be more natural than for the Cardinal who has married Robert and Constance to wish to pay his compliments to the new king and queen? And once I'm close enough, one disruptor blast, one slashed throat, and it will all be over, with no time for anyone to do anything. And then the fun will really begin.
Valentine sailed happily out of the private room, leaving Brendan's dead body lying on the floor, and made his way briskly through the crowds, heading straight for the happy couple like a shark that's just scented blood in the water. His hollow disguise was perfect, and no one gave him a second look. His heart beat rapidly as he bore down on the king and queen, and they turned to meet him, entirely unsuspecting. There was a news cameraman nearby, and Valentine beckoned to him imperiously. He wanted the whole empire to see what he was about to do. Flynn nodded quickly to the Cardinal and hurried forward to get a better shot. But when he looked through his camera, he saw again the same vague distortion he'd seen around the young Sister of Mercy earlier.
Damn it.
He wondered if he'd have to dismantle the whole damned camera to find out what the problem was. There couldn't be anything wrong with the signal going out, or Toby would have been yelling in his ear by now. Flynn looked at the apparent energy field again, still not sure what he was seeing. He ran quickly through the camera's most recent update menus, searching for possibilities.
Oh, shit.
The camera told him the most likely answer was a holo disguise. Flynn looked at the scene through his own eyes, saw how close the Cardinal was to the King and Queen, and how far away the nearest elves were, and did the only thing he could.
Robert! Watch the fuck out!
Flynn sent his camera shooting forward at full speed. It locked straight onto the holo signal emanating from Brendan. The camera crashed right into the hidden holo camera on the Cardinal's shoulder, knocking it away. Once out of contact with its user, the camera's holo field collapsed, and suddenly there was Valentine Wolfe, with scarlet mouth and mascaraed eyes, and a gun and knife in his hands. Valentine looked around him, startled, only slowly realizing what must have happened. Elves came running from all directions. Robert moved quickly to stand between his bride and the new danger, his ceremonial sword at the ready before him. Valentine calmly raised his gun.
No!
Robert stood his ground, protecting Constance with his own body. The elves, struggling through the packed crowd, lashed out with their minds, but Valentine's own esp was just strong enough to confuse them. Their attacks went wide. Valentine's gun centered on Robert's chest.
Everybody stop right where they are.
The elves reluctantly slowed to a halt. Valentine looked at Robert with fever-bright eyes and licked his lips.
Give me your crown. You know it really should be mine. And it's only fitting that a king should give way to an emperor.
Mad as ever, Valentine. Kill me and you'll never leave here alive.
Oh, I think I will. Nothing can kill me now. I've moved far beyond such human weaknesses. I'm glad it's come down to you and I in the end. How very fitting after all this time that the last real Campbell should meet his end at the hands of the last real wolf.
Not even close, Valentine.
The unknown clone pushed forward to stand at Robert's side. He reached up and pulled off his mask to reveal the grim face of Finley Campbell.
Well met, old enemy. Aren't you supposed to be dead?
You're a fine one to talk. I thought I'd finally got rid of you and Tower Shrek.
Oh, I don't do the dying thing anymore. I cannot be stopped by anyone.
Really? Let's test that.
His sword lashed out with dizzying speed, and the tip raked across the back of Valentine's hand, severing the tendons. Valentine's fingers opened automatically, and the disruptor dropped from his hand. The tendons knit back together again almost immediately, and Valentine quickly brought his sword into position as Finley advanced on him. Valentine smiled at Robert.
Bet I can pick up my gun and use it before you or your cow can run 3 paces, so stay put and watch the show. I'll get round to you. But first, the 2 true inheritors of Clan Wolfe and Clan Campbell locked in mortal combat one last time. Ah, Finley, how proud our fathers would be of us.
Shut up and fight.
They both moved forward, their swords clashing together and then springing apart as they circled each other, their arms moving so fast they were little more than blurs. Valentine had been trained in swordsmanship by the finest tutors wolf money could buy, but Finley had been the masked gladiator, undefeated champion of the Golgotha arenas. The fight had hardly begun before Finley tricked the wolf into lowering his guard for just a moment, and then the Campbell stepped forward in an extended lunge and ran Valentine through. His sword slammed into Valentine just under the breastbone and burst out of his back in a flurry of flying blood. A perfect killing blow. But Valentine didn't fall.
Oh, dear. I've been run through.
And while Finley still held his extended lunge, confused, Valentine thrust his own sword toward Finley's belly. Powered by shove-driven strength, Valentine's blade punched right through Finley's armor, burying itself deep in his gut. Finley fell backward, clutching at the bloody wound with both hands as Valentine's blade left his body. Dark blood pulsed thickly between his fingers. After Valentine pulled Finley's sword out of his body, He let it fall to the floor. His own wound healed almost immediately, closed and sealed by Shub Nanotech. Evangeline and Adrienne grabbed Finley and dragged him away. Fortunately for him, there was a regeneration machine on standby in one of the private rooms. The elves had insisted. Valentine looked unhurriedly about him.
Anyone else? No? Well then, as I was saying before I was so rudely interrupted...
Get away from the king!
Everyone turned to look as Kit Summerisle came striding through the crowd. Valentine nodded thoughtfully and lifted his sword, but made no move to pick up his gun. He could have any time, and everyone knew it, but he was having far too much fun. He did so love to tease his enemies. He bowed lightly as Kid Death came to a halt before him, sword in hand.
Typical. I take my eye off the ball for a few moments, and everything goes to hell. Come on, Wolf, let's do it. You know you want to.
Oh, why not? Always time for a little pleasure before business.
They came together in a flurry of flashing blades and stamping feet, both showing their teeth and smiles that had no true humor in them. Again, the fight was fast and furious, but Kit had time to see Finley's mistake and kept his distance. Since running the wolf through clearly didn't work, Kid Death concentrated on whittling away at his opponent, cutting and slicing at the wolf's pale flesh. But the wounds sealed themselves as fast as they were inflicted, and if Valentine felt any pain, it didn't bother him in the least. Kit parried Valentine's blows with almost arrogant skill and ease, but he couldn't help noticing that the attacks were coming faster and stronger all the time. Almost inhumanly fast. Kit held his ground anyway. He knew there was nowhere to go. His calm killer's mind assessed the situation logically. He couldn't hurt or harm the wolf, so that just left. He grinned suddenly, chose the time and angle of blow carefully, and lashed out at Valentine's sword arm with a tremendous double-handed swing. The blade cut off Valentine's sword arm right at the elbow. The severed arm fell to the floor, still clutching the sword. For a moment, no one moved. Valentine looked down at his severed arm as the relaxing fingers let go of the sword hilt. A few drops of blood fell from the stump of his arm and then stopped.
Oh dear.
And four fingers and a thumb thrust out of the great wound at his elbow. A hand followed, and then the forearm, and in a moment, Valentine was whole again. He stooped down and picked up his sword, kicked aside the severed arm, and gestured for Kit to come at him again. Kid Death raised his sword, thinking hard. But even as their swords reached out to touch again, the elves hit Valentine with everything they had. As long as Robert and Constance were in danger from Valentine, they hadn't dared start anything. But now that his concentration seemed wholly on Kid Death, Crojane gave a telepathic signal, and a psi storm of violent energies hit Valentine from a dozen different directions at once. One Poulter grabbed the gun and whisked it away, while six others did their best to tear Valentine apart. Psychokinetic flames sprang up around him, burning so fiercely everyone else had to back away. Telepaths probed and picked at the locked doors of his mind. Valentine stood his ground, nanotech rebuilding his body faster than it could be destroyed. Robert and Constance stood their ground too, though voices and clutching hands tried to persuade them to flee. The whole empire was watching, and the new king and queen couldn't be seen to be weak. When the psi storm finally collapsed, the elves shattered and exhausted, and the last flames died away, Valentine Wolf was still standing there, apparently untouched.
Everybody finished? Everybody had their turn? Good! Now that you all know I'm unstoppable, unkillable, and quite possibly immortal, who could be a more sensible choice as Emperor? You know in your hearts that I'm what you really need, what you deserve.
He turned slowly to face Robert and Constance.
Now, time to play.
Kit Summerisle started forward again, and Valentine slapped him aside with one sweep of his arm. Then advanced on the grim-faced but unmoving Robert. And then, Daniel Wolf appeared out of nowhere, teleporting in to stand beside his brother. Valentine glared at him.
What the hell are you doing here? I don't need any help from you or Shub. This is my business. Don't you dare interfere.
People of the court, I speak for Shub. The war between the AIs and humanity is now over. The AIs have called off all their forces and recalled their armada to turn them against our mutual enemies, the Hayden Men and the Recreated.
Examine your communications and you will find proof of all I say. The nanotech plague is also at an end. The nanos have been rendered inert. The AIs cannot restore those already destroyed, but there will be no more victims. The long war between us is over. Rejoice.
Only you remain, brother. One last piece of unfinished business. I asked for the privilege of shutting you down, now that I am my own man again, and they agreed. So goodbye, brother. Enjoy your time in hell.
And with those words, every piece of Shub nanotech in Valentine's body shut itself down. All his wounds burst open at once, and Valentine fell to the bloodied floor in a wet heap. He'd been so close to winning everything. In moments, he was soaked in his own blood, as he writhed helplessly at the feet of those he'd wanted so much to see crawling before him. He tried to lift his sword to strike one last blow for spite's sake, but there was no strength left in him. He bled to death, and no one made any move to save him. When it was over, Daniel bowed formally to Constance.
Hello, stepmother. I'm home at last. Congratulations on your wedding. Hope you liked the present I brought. I'm sure my father would look favorably on your new life. Shub never really had him, you know. They only had his body. His spirit has always been at rest.
I always knew that. I'm glad you've come to know that, too. Welcome home, Daniel. What the hell happened to the AIs? Is the war really over?
Oh, yes. Diana Virtue opened their minds to new possibilities. Shub are our allies now.
Captain Eden Cross appeared suddenly on a floating view screen, hanging above everyone's head, breaking through security on an emergency channel.
This is Captain Cross of the Excalibur. Since Shub is no longer a threat, we're going to face the Recreated. But my ship is the only survivor of my fleet, and it's in terrible shape. The last standing isn't much better off. We're calling in every ship we've got, and Shub is sending everything they've got to back us up. But the sheer size of the Recreated fleet is almost unimaginable. We can't hope to stop them on our own. We need every ship that can fly and aim a gun, and we need every able man and woman left to crew them. This message is being broadcast all across Golgotha. If you can hear my voice, your empire needs you. It's time to make our stand.
All eyes turned to Robert.
You heard the man. We're all needed. I'm reinstating myself as captain and taking my old ship out to face the Recreated. Let every man and woman here, for whom duty and honor are more than just words, follow me. No ship is too small, no aid too slight. We must fight or fall together. And if we must fall, let whoever or whatever remains to write the history books declare this was humanity's finest hour.
He strode out of the house, Constance at his side, and in ones and twos, and then in great streams, everyone in the house followed them out. Even the barely recovered Finley Campbell, fresh out of the regeneration machine, brought up the rear, leaning heavily on Evangeline and Adrienne. By the time Toby Schreck made his way down from the control gallery, only Flynn was left, checking his camera for damage.
Tell me you got all that, Flynn.
Every second, boss. Going out live to every planet in the Empire. Damn, if everyone else follows King Robert's lead, we're going to have an Imperial fleet of a size not seen since the days of the old Empire.
Damn right. And we're going to be a part of it. I've commandeered a new ship, and it's waiting for us on the Parliament landing pads. I'm not missing out on the biggest story of my career.
And then they both looked around sharply at a sudden noise behind them. And there was Kit Summerisle, Kid Death, staggering out of one of the private rooms, bleeding from a dozen terrible wounds. They started toward him, and he tried to say something to them, but he collapsed, betrayed by his own dying body. Toby knelt beside him, looking almost in awe at the great wounds, killing the most notorious assassin the Empire had ever known. None of them were due to Valentine. The wolf hadn't been able to touch him. The whole of Kit's body was soaked in blood, and one of his eyes had been cut out of his head.
Who did this to you? Who the hell could have done this to you?
David.
Toby and Flynn looked at each other over his body, and then went cautiously to search the room Kadeth had staggered out of. But it was empty, though there was a lot of blood on the floor, and two sets of bloody boot marks. They checked all the other rooms, but they were empty too. If there did still remain some secret unknown killer, there was no sight or sound of him. So in the end, Toby and Flynn just shrugged, left the house, and went to board their ship to join the last great fleet of humanity into battle against its last great enemy, the Recreated. Among the dust of forgotten suns, in a darkness that no longer knew the light and life of stars, Owen Deathstalker and Hazel Dark came again to the Wolfling world in their ship, Sunstrider 3. In many ways, this long-neglected return felt to Owen and Hazel very much like coming home. Down in the subterranean mysteries of the frozen planet beneath them, they had walked through the madness maze and emerged reborn as something new in the universe. And since that time, they had done many things, some good and some bad, but all of them quite remarkable. They had rewritten the history of the Empire and of humanity itself, and all it had cost them was control of their own lives and of their destiny. Once there had been 5 remarkable people, survivors of the Madness Maze, but 3 of them were dead. Giles Deathstalker, that legendary hero and warrior, died at the hands of his own descendant, while Jack Random and Ruby Journey had died at each other's hand. Owen and Hazel knew this the moment they dropped out of hyperspace and the Sunstrider 3 took up its pre-programmed orbit around the Wolfling world. There had always been a strong mental link between the maze survivors, neglected as they would, and Owen and Hazel cried out in unison as the knowledge crashed in upon them, like the sudden amputation of part of their souls. Jack and Ruby had been their friends, and more than friends, despite their many differences, comrades in arms and kindred spirits, and Owen and Hazel knew that for as long as they lived, there would always be a space in their hearts and a gap in their lives no one else would ever be able to make good. Owen, sitting slumped in the bridge command chair, looked at the central view screen, but didn't see it. The screen showed the shimmering icy surface of the planet below, all subdued blues and greens, but his thoughts were elsewhere.
We're the last now, the last of our kind. I feel like the last of a species doomed to extinction.
I don't. The Empire has no shortage of freaks and superhumans and general weird shit these days. That's always been a part of the problem, to my mind. Humanity getting above itself, messing about with powers and abilities it has no business even knowing about yet. We're not ready to be gods.
Are you saying you won't miss Jack and Ruby?
Of course I'll miss them. Ruby was my oldest friend. She believed in me when no one else did, not even me. She always knew that we were somebody, that we were destined for great things. You only ever knew her as a bounty hunter and a killer. I knew her when she was so much more than that. You never knew what she lost, what she gave up to become who and what she was. Her whole life was a tragedy, just waiting for a bad and bitter ending. But I never thought she'd die so young, and at the hands of the only man she ever loved.
Jack Random was always one of my heroes. Studying history soon disillusioned you about most heroes and legends. But Jack really did do most of the things they said he did. And even after they broke him, and he was safe being a nobody on Mistworld, he still found the strength to recreate himself, to be the hero and legend again, to risk his life and his sanity one more time, because the cause needed him. And because I asked him to. I'm responsible for everything he became, and everything he did, the good and the bad.
Now that is just typical of you, Deathstalker, trying to take everyone's burdens on your shoulders. Jack Random was responsible for his own life and his own madness at the end. Ruby, too. Whatever they did and whatever end they came to, it was by their own choice and their own will. Just like us when our times come. To believe anything else diminishes them and us.
Our time? Have you been having those precognitive dreams again? Is there something about our being here I should know?
No. We have enough real threats to worry about without bringing in my dreams. Now why don't you make yourself useful for a change? See if you can raise the Wolfling down below. We're really vulnerable here in orbit, if there are any of the Recreated left in the Dark Void.
Owen nodded and turned to the comm panels. Hazel watched him, scowling,
and wondered why she was so reluctant to tell him about the dream she'd once had of her future, of standing alone on the bridge of the Sunstrider 2, while all hell broke out around her. Huge alien forces attacking from every side, strange ships and awful creatures beyond counting, nightmares let loose in the waking world, blowing the Sunstrider 2 apart for all its shields and defenses, fires burning the length of the ship, alarms sounding endlessly, and the ship's guns firing again and again and again. Below her, the Wolfling world, and no sign of Owen anywhere. Now she'd come at last to the place of the dream, but the details were no longer accurate. Sunstrider 2 was destroyed, crashed on the leper world of Lacrimae Christi. All that remained of that ship was its unique star drive, built into a hijacked church ship. The new Sunstrider 3 didn't even have any guns, so the dream was now impossible. She was safe from the overwhelming horror she'd felt, of the terrible, inevitable doom she'd felt closing in around her. And no trace of Owen anywhere. The dream was clearly now just a dream. That was why she kept quiet about it. Or so she told herself. But the Wolfling world lay cold and silent beneath the ship, like a pale, ghostly harbinger of bad things to come.
We are the last of the Maze people. The last of the great rebel leaders. And just maybe the last hope of humanity. Why does destiny always land most heavily on the shoulders of those who feel least able of handling the burden?
Hazel!
Hazel looked around suddenly when a familiar voice spoke from the viewscreen, and it wasn't the Wolfling. The screen was now filled with the head and shoulders of Diana Virtue. She looked tired and strained and subtly different, and it took Hazel a moment to realize that Diana didn't look like herself anymore. Her mouth was a grim, flat line, and her eyes were dangerously dark and staring. A disturbing sense of menace and barely channeled madness surrounded her, like a halo of flies. She looked like her old self, the deadly Esper Saint, Jenny Psycho.
It's all gone wrong. We hit the Recreated with everything we had, and barely slowed it down. I helped the masked mind of the Mater Mundi join with the AIs. And together we tried to force mental contact with the Recreated. To shock them awake and sane, as we did with Shub. But it didn't even come close to working. Contact wasn't possible. The Recreated are too strong, too angry, too insane, too strange. It was like staring into a sun that never stopped screaming. Whatever the Recreated are, they're far beyond anything we can hope to comprehend or deal with. The Mater Mundi is in shock. Blasted back into its component parts, reeling on the edge of sanity. I had to become Jenny Psycho again, in self-defense. It was the only way to deal with such a threat to my soul. If I think too much about what I saw and felt, I think I'd start screaming too and never stop. Shub came off best. Because they couldn't manage any kind of contact. The sheer weirdness of the Recreated had no common ground with their logic. That protected the AIs from the psychic backlash. Right now, everyone who can fly a ship or aim a gun is charging down the throat of the Recreated fleet, weapons blazing. We're trying to slow them down, to buy you some time to pull one last miracle out of the hat. But don't take too long to come up with something, Deathstalker, Doc. Every minute we buy for you is being paid with human lives and suffering. But you're not alone. Captain Silence and the Dauntless should be there with you by now. Try to forget old enmities, Deathstalker. Humanity is in dire need of help, and we don't much care where it comes from.
The signal suddenly became blurred and distorted. Jenny Psycho looking sharply back over her shoulder at something off-screen. Owen shuddered briefly, unnerved by the very sound. He would have liked to say something comforting to Jenny, but he had no idea what. What can you say when the fate of your whole species lies in your hands, and you don't have one damned clue what to do? Owen chewed the inside of his cheek, scowling thoughtfully. He hadn't come into the Dark Void again to fight humanity's last battle. He'd returned to the Wolfling world to deal with old, unfinished business. The Madness Maze was now back, apparently, and the baby in the crystal at the heart of the maze was waking up.
Since the last time the baby was awake, he put out 1,000 suns in a moment, destroyed billions of lives, and created the Dark Void. Owen felt he had a responsibility to return and do what he could. If only because, as Giles's clone, the baby was family.
But now Silence and the Dauntless are on their way too, and that complicates things. I know they're here because Parliament wants the Dark Void device to use against the Recreated. But Parliament and Silence don't know the device is just a baby, beyond any hope of manipulation or control. The one time Giles tried to use the baby's powers to deal with a few rebel planets, he became responsible for the greatest case of murder in human history. Who knows what the baby might do if allowed to wake again.
Well, are we going to contact the Dauntless?
Not just yet, I think. I think we need to get down there first and appraise the situation, before Silence and his people arrive to confuse the hell out of things. I mean, all we know is what the Wolfling told us. He could be mistaken, or lying, or...
Or...
Precisely. I'll move us into a suitable low orbit where we'll be less easily detected. You try again to raise the Wolfling on the comm.
Hazel shrugged and turned back to the comm panels. She hadn't forgotten the last time Silence came to the Wolfling world in pursuit of the price on their heads and ended up destroying the Madness Maze, as well as trying to kill her and the other maze people. They'd all made a kind of peace over Lionstone's body and the hell she'd made of her court, but that had been politics, nothing more, and they'd all been careful to maintain a respectful distance ever since. Some wounds and divisions can only be healed by time. Lots of it. Owen moved the Sunstrider 3 into low orbit, his mind meshing easily with the ship's computer systems through his comlink, operating the navigation systems directly by his thoughts. When Moon rebuilt the Sunstrider 3 around the previous ship's star drive, he hadn't been able to resist bringing the computers up to his own more than human standards. Once, Owen would have needed an AI to interface between his thoughts and the computers, to avoid unfortunate foul-ups through drifting attention, but a more disciplined mind was only one of the changes the maze continued to work in him. He still missed Oz, though. He settled the ship into a suitable orbit, raised all the shields, carefully disengaged his mind from the computers, and turned to Hazel. She'd pushed her chair back from the comm panels and was shaking her head angrily. She glared at Owen and folded her arms sulkily across her chest.
He must be able to hear us, but he's not answering. If I put any more power into the comm signal, the planet would start to melt. Maybe he's mad at us for not getting here sooner. Hell, maybe the baby woke up and made him disappear. We've no way of knowing what's going on down there.
No, I think we'd know if the baby were awake. Either we'd feel it, or the universe might just start unraveling around us. As long as reality continues undisturbed, I think we can assume the baby is still safely sleeping. Wolf's probably just being precious, keeping us waiting till he's ready to talk to us. He never did have much use for humans.
Well, we did wipe out all his species but him. That had to make an impression. Giles was the only human the Wolfling ever had any time for, and you killed him.
Quite. Let us hope very fervently that Wolf doesn't bear grudges. In the meantime, we'd better change our clothes. Our present attire, apart from being decidedly bloody and tattered from our time among the Bloodrunners, is entirely unsuitable for the chill of the caverns of the Wolfling world.
Hazel followed Owen reluctantly into the cramped lounge area behind the bridge.
You know, you can be really fussy sometimes. I mean, the Wolfling isn't going to care what we look like.
Owen made a face and opened the clothes locker and began to root dubiously through the limited selection.
I care. I am the Deathstalker, and I will not appear before the Wolfling looking like some tramp. It's a question of dignity.
In response, Hazel decided to reject the first three things Owen showed her. There wasn't that much choice, really, the locker's stock being limited to what Moon and Owen had been able to acquire from St. B's mission and the original church ship. But eventually, Owen and Hazel settled on suitable clothing they could both live with, topped with heavy cloaks to keep out the cold. Hazel paused briefly as Owen swung his cloak about him and admired himself in the locker's full-length mirror. The hackles on her neck were standing up. She'd seen Owen in that cloak before. On the two occasions when he'd appeared suddenly out of nowhere, first to save her life in the standing on Viramond, and then again later in the mission to try and warn her about the Bloodrunners. He'd been wearing these very clothes, but had looked tired and hurt and desperate. A slow chill wrapped itself around Hazel's heart as she began to understand what that meant, what it had to mean. Owen and Hazel ran back onto the bridge and bent over the control panels looking for trouble. Nothing was obviously wrong. until Owen thought to check the sensor readings.
It's a proximity warning. Something's coming our way. Something big. And it's moving bloody quickly.
Could it be silence on the Dauntless?
I don't think so. The sensor readings make no sense at all. I'm switching to long range. That should put something on the view screen.
Hazel was strangely silent, moving to stand as close as she could to Owen. On the view screen, great shapes were gathering beyond the Wolfling world, like vultures over something dying. Huge ships the size of mountains or small moons, with insane structures and convoluted shapes that sucked the eye in uneasy directions. There seemed no real edge or end to them, as though they were still, always, just dropping out of hyperspace into normal reality. And between and around these awful ships, strange, monstrous shapes, alive, aware, and completely unprotected in the cold vacuum of space. Some were almost as big as the ships, vast alien creatures with eyes like spotlights and barbed tentacles that stretched for miles. There were claws and teeth and staring eyes and repulsive entities the size of cities that shouldn't, couldn't exist. They shone with their own unhealthy light, vast shapes and horrid creatures without number, gathering silently on all sides of the beleaguered planet. The Recreated had come to the Wolfling world.
End of Disc 1. Deathstalker Destiny is continued on the next CD.